You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. As we speak, there's people scurrying. Who was this guy? Where in Illinois is this place?
But when you talk about disruption, don't you know that you can count me out?
You know, I'll tell you what, the Capitol officers who were there on site, you know, God bless them. You know, No, this discussion about, you know, how first responders react, I think for those of us who are old enough to remember it, watching the Columbine thing, kids being shot inside the school, you see all kinds of policemen outside the school, guns drawn, you know, pointed over the roof of their squad cars. You know, I think we've learned a lot since then, in that you've got to go and you've got to confront them now. You've got to put an end to this. And both officers wounded, and so thoughts and prayers go out to them. But there's a Native American saying that I heard when I lived in North Dakota, which is the land of the Sioux warrior, the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribes, and some of the greatest Native American warriors came from those three tribes. And they're tremendously proud of it too. That saying, today's a good day to die. You know, and when you're a first responder, I mean, you know, it might get pointed in your direction one day, and you may have to make that decision. And I'll never forget, there was a young man who was a security guard outside of Red Lake Falls High School when somebody with a gun approached the high school, and he was unarmed, and he saw them with a weapon drawn heading into the school, and he yelled at him and he ran towards them. Well, he was shot and killed, but you know what, I've never forgotten his courage on a day when with no unarmed, but he knew what his job was, and he was not going to shrink from it. There's a picture of this guy, James Hodgkin, on Fox News right now. He's from Belleville, Illinois, and this is supposedly a picture from the Belleville News Democrat, and sent to Fox News by somebody. And the sign says, tax the rich like Congress did for 70 years till Reagan's trickle down, we need, and then the rest of the sign is blocked. But again, the biggest news of the morning is he didn't have any shooting skill, because he fired, by all accounts, close to 50 rounds, and he didn't hit anything. So we're thankful. Everybody ought to be thankful for that. And again, just another warning. The question is, will the warning be heeded? You know, and what is the lesson? Is the lesson we need better security? If that's the lesson, then you're crazy. We need people to lead the country. We need people that know how to compromise. The whole healthcare thing, the reform of the tax code, are all problems that cry for solutions. And what do we watch? What the theater we watch? And I'll go back to my discussion about compromise. The senator named Byron Dorgan. So I can't remember how many terms he served in the Senate, but what he told me when I interviewed him, he said, I'll go back to the conversation. He said, you know, Mac, compromise is the lubricant of democracy. He said, but you know what you get when you compromise now? The only thing that you will assure yourself of is a contested primary in your own party when you go to run for reelection. You will be called a sellout. Now, this is where I thought this kind of an interesting little discussion. So what is this, the rise of this scorched earth relative to compromise? When does it happen? Is it with the rise of the right-wing Republican talk show host? As Rush Limbaugh becomes popular, is that when you can't compromise anymore? And this whole notion of the fairness doctrine in broadcasting, when you had to air both sides of a discussion, and then that was done away with, I want to say, in the 80s and officially in the 90s, officially done away with by the FCC. So if you use the public airwaves, you were bound to represent both sides. And so when you have programs that use the public airwaves that don't, you have programs like Hannity Combs, right? You had both arguments there. So again, and again, my prototype always is the McNeil Lear NewsHour. Smart people are discussing difficult issues, footnoting them in a respectful way. But the problem is our media is its own private industry. And like every other industry, they seek to maximize, that's right, their profit. And how do you do that? You get the most traffic. You're able to charge the highest advertising rates. That's how it works. What sells? Responsible, measured journalism? I don't think so. I don't think so. That's not what sells. What sells is the most shrill screaming from the highest mountain. And then how does that change? You know, the expectation that they'll stand at some moral ground someplace? I think you're on a fool's errand there. So, again, I don't know. Mike and I have mused. What happens to change the country? Do we need an event like this guy actually walking into that baseball diamond where these senators and representatives are caged and killing 15 or 20 of them? Which, to be honest with you, he could have done easily. All he had to do was walk across that field. As they hid in the dugout to walk up to it with a rifle, with a 30-round magazine, poof, 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 at point blank, as they hid in the dugout and shoot them all. Do we need an event like that to send a message that, you know what, it's got out of control? But again, I don't know that the political powers in this country would that even register? It's painful. It's painful. And I'll tell you what, and we who have fought, you come home and you look at it, shake your head. You sent us to Iraq for what? So you could walk away from it? Because that was a political promise you made? So you could walk away from Afghanistan because that was a political promise you made? I mean, Barack Obama was a horrible president. You know, and people can talk about his social programs and whatnot. He hurt the country internationally incredibly. His actions in Afghanistan, his actions in the Middle East, his ingratiating himself or attempting to think that he could deal with Iran has let Iran out of the box. I mean, why are we all of a sudden confronted with North Korea in this state? Where was any action that could have been taken prior to this? Answer, didn't get taken. So, anyway, my point is we need to be better. I'm not sure how we do it. I'm not, again, do we need more incidents like this? God forbid. It's just painful. Painful. And yet, ask them to govern responsibly. Ask them to behave responsibly. And it's just, I don't know, it's just something they can't do. And I don't know what turns it around. We're going to take a quick break. Phil Smith is going to join us. We're going to talk about day three at Gettysburg. Gettysburg is going to rescue us from this this morning discourse. So more of All Marine Radio coming up next. We've been we'll set it up, but we talked about day we talked about the precursor to the Gettysburg campaign. So we're going to lay out the disposition of forces at Gettysburg on this first day. As the sun came up, and we'll talk about some decision making at Gettysburg, which changed the trajectory of American history. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on a Wednesday, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff. I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Six minutes after nine on a Wednesday. Mike McNamara with you. All Marine Radio continues. And joining me is Philip E. Smith, United States Marine Corps retired, colonel type. And Smitty, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much. It's kind of a hot, muggy day here in South Carolina.
That's a shocker, huh? Nobody expected that.
Yeah, particularly upstate. I think you expect it down the mid-state and along the coast, but not so much up here.
In the Blue Ridge?
Yeah, close to the Blue Ridge, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You expect a little bit drier weather, but South Carolina known for a little bit of that muggy stuff. And then you get all the bugs that go with it. That's always pleasant.
Yep, always pleasant. Yeah, so you got to have bug spray in large quantities.
God help us. We're going to talk about Gettysburg here in a minute. But I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your thoughts about today, shooting in Alexandria. I had Mike Musselman on a little bit ago. I don't know if you know Mike, but he said, one of the things you got to thank is this guy wasn't a trained Marine marksman, because if he had a long rifle with a magazine, and you have a bunch of senators and representatives fenced in a baseball field, anybody with some halfway decent marksmanship skills and that kind of weapon could have killed an awful lot of people in a very short period of time.
Yeah, he obviously didn't do appropriate sighting in and zeroing of his weapon, but he was also 66 years old. I would imagine somebody like that probably doesn't get to a range too often, particularly in that part of the country. But very fortunate that he did know how to shoot very well.
So we'll keep our eyes on that. The president spoken. The shooter is dead. As many as 50 shots were fired. And again, to have 50 shots fired with maybe probably the majority with a long rifle, and only have four people wounded. Everything I've seen has said none of the injuries of them are life-threatening. That's a little bit of a miracle. So again, keep our fingers crossed that none of that changes. And as we kind of head towards Gettysburg.
Kudos to the Capitol, I think.
Yeah, I think we've watched different events like this unfold, and you and I have talked decision making, and I mean, one of the things you have to do to inject into that equation is you have to inject uncertainty into the shooter's head to get him off of whatever he's trying to shoot at. And I don't care if you may not know where he is, simply the sound of your weapon being discharged into the ground, right? Well, that wasn't me. What was that? Now he's got to turn and face you. And now it gives his prey, some time. And so, very quick action by first responders, in this case, the Capitol Police. And here, the interesting story is, had it not been for the fact that the majority whip was there, there would have been no security there, which is relatively interesting.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. The fact that those guys travel around pretty much unsecure as individuals all the time is kind of scary. But one of the things that you mentioned about, what police do, when they first engage, they're pretty much taught that they have to have a target before they engage. So maybe we're on the verge of retraining police in this type of an environment, to do suppression and do distraction, just like you had mentioned, in order to create confusion in the mind of shooters. That may be something we have to look at.
Well, and we're going to talk about Gettysburg, and what I love about, I first remember going on a kind of a battlefield tour, and at the end of it, I mean, and I enjoyed it, but at the end of it, I thought, man, what a waste, because there's so much more you can learn up there, and I've always been kind of I always have loved looking at decision making. And when you're on a battlefield and you have access to first-person accounts and you can take professionals there and you can begin to look at the decisions that got made and they can learn vicariously something that will help them in combat, man, that's an incredible opportunity. And so my approach and the things I've learned from that contributed to an argument I got into after the Columbine thing with some kind of law enforcement guy I had on the radio, and he said, "Well, I think your expectation with the police, the situation is unknown and blah blah." I said, "I don't care. you've got to go into that school, and I don't care if you shoot six rounds into somebody's wall locker. They've got to hear it, and you've got to make them come or at least begin to account for you, which slows down their ability to kill innocent people. And he went, well, we don't train like that. He made the same comment you made. We don't train like that. And I said, well, you know, in these situations, you know, how do you get them to stop? How do you affect their behavior? It's not by silently prowling around. You got to make your presence known and make them begin to respond to you. And so how you do that, I don't know. But I think that's part of the solution in that crisis relative to getting them off defenseless people and getting them to deal with you. So, and again, that all comes from what we're about to do, which is decision making. So to me, it's a little bit of an interesting piece of this.
Yep. I agree.
All right. We talked about the campaign. The campaign gets going on the 3rd of June, and where we find ourselves this morning is let me let you, Smitty, you want to paint the general situation on the morning of July 1st as the sun comes up?
Oh. Okay. All right. Well, we've got Reynolds Corps and we've got Buford's Cavalry moving in from the north, from the vicinity of D.C., Reynolds is kind of following Buford, and in this particular case, we've got a comparison to make with Buford's cavalry doing for Reynolds what Stuart is not doing for either Ewell or Longstreet. We talked a little bit about the last time how Lee's instructions to Stuart left Stuart to discern and decide what he thought he would do as opposed to making a better decision as to what Lee wanted him to do. But anyway, Stuart is out of action on this first day, not even in the AO. So Buford is tracking Ewell and the nose of AP Hill's Corps coming up out of the valley. And if you look at a map and you look at Gettysburg, I was surprised at this again, but there are a minimum of 10 roads leading towards and into the vicinity of Gettysburg. So it's pretty easy to understand, at least from a historical perspective, and certainly they had maps back in those days where you know, many of those roads would have shown up on maps that they would look at and plan for. But this was an unplanned meeting. It just happened that roads of the day led towards this little burg of Gettysburg. And Ewell is already around Gettysburg. He's to the north and to the west, actually up in Carlisle, heading towards Harrisburg and the Susquehanna River.
Okay, so if Gettysburg is in the center of our clock, Ewell is what? He's at what, 2 o'clock on the clock?
12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, yeah.
And he's headed for Harrisburg, threatening Harrisburg, yes?
Yes. Yes. Yep. Threatening Harrisburg with the hopes, I think, of moving across the Susquehanna to try to get the Union Army to come further to the north and to the east as opposed to west, which is kind of where they end up, north
okay.
and west.
All right. So they're at about 1 o'clock threatening along the Susquehanna River, threatening the capital of Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania, yes?
I'm not sure if Harrisburg. Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Caught you on that one, huh? State capitals for 100? Smitty. I think it is.
Okay, but anyway, I'm not sure that that's where he is or why he's going towards Harrisburg. It's just
it
that
is,
Harrisburg.
It is the state capital. Okay. It is the state capital. Okay, So that's where Ewell's Corps is, all right? And so the next corps that we're going to look at is Hill's Corps. And where is Hill's Corps?
He is in the vicinity of Chambersburg, is just almost to the west of Gettysburg. And he's got one brigade that under Heth, Heth is the brigade commander, going in towards Gettysburg, and they're just scouting during basically what a cavalry unit should be doing, but they're really doing some logistics scavenging, and in this particular case, looking for shoes in specific, so they can continue their march.
Okay, but, so everybody can picture this. So Gettysburg is in the center of the clock. And then there's the mountains that the Army of Northern Virginia has stayed to the west of those mountains, and I think you have to go from the mountains. You got to go through Greencastle and Cashtown as you head east towards Gettysburg, and that's AP Hill. Where's Longstreet?
Longstreet is almost directly to the south. He's taking more of a direct route towards Gettysburg, but he's not following Ewell and Hill. He's a little bit further to the east, coming up to the east of Harper's Ferry, crossing that way and coming up almost directly to the south on, I can't remember the name of the road it is, but I think it's Chambersburg Road eventually.
Okay, so that's the array of the Army of Northern Virginia. And Stuart at this point is what? He's somewhere at 3 o'clock or maybe 4 o'clock, trying to get north of the Union Army so he can rejoin Lee. He knows he's in trouble.
Yeah. In specific, he's trying to his instructions was to track to the west of Longstreet.
Right.
I've got to do a little bit more research as to why he didn't stay close enough. But eventually he tries to get around. To the east, hook up with Ewell. He knows Ewell's in the lead, so I think he eventually refocuses on Ewell by trying to stay in closer to Longstreet.
Well, his instructions after he has his big parade at Brandy Station is, you can go threaten D.C. and create a general fervor around there. But after that, I need you on my eastern flank between me and Meade. So that I know his whereabouts. And then I think Lee's lament is what? I'm going into battle with one shoe off because Stuart's not there. And so Stuart's trying to get there, but maybe the speed, he miscalculates the speed that the Army of the Potomac, who's now under new leadership, and I think we talked about that last week, but it's one of the features of this battle, which is you have the first string for the first time, and you have a lot of it focused in the vanguard of the Army of the Potomac, and that is guys like Buford, guys like Reynolds, guys like Hancock are all pushing north, many of them going back into their home state, and they're not messing around. They're moving. And as Stuart threatens D.C., he then tries to turn west, and he keeps bumping into elements of the Army of the Potomac. And so he keeps bouncing north, trying to get to Lee, and he can't get there. And so what you have is Lee on the eastern side of Gettysburg, being pushed out by the Army of the Potomac's advanced units, and Lee knows that he's not where he's supposed to be. So that's kind of the general situation for the Confederacy. For the Union, tell us about Buford. Buford's what? He's picketing the Blue Ridges, right? The passes and kind of skirmishing with some of the elements of the Army of Northern Virginia as they move north.
Yeah, and I think eventually Buford has a pretty good line on where Ewell is, although it's probably not until late June, 29 or 30 June. Still not an effective cavalryman, at least for working for me to let me advise Meade on where the Army of the Northern Virginia is headed. But anyway, he is doing a tactical reconnaissance in front of Reynolds Corps, and he bumps into, in Gettysburg, into Hess Brigade looking for shoes. So that neither
okay, hold
the
on.
Army at this
before we get there. So you have Buford is screening the left flank of the Army of the Potomac, and he is essentially bouncing his units from pass to pass to pass as they do. One of his missions is don't let the Confederate the Army of Northern Virginia see where we are. So if we own those passes, we'll limit their opportunities to come through and check us out. And two, keep tabs of where Lee is. So Meade has a pretty good idea. Lee has a pretty good idea where Meade is, or Meade has a pretty good idea where Lee and his different elements are. Lee, on the other hand, does not have a good idea where Meade is generally, and certainly where his units are. So you have Buford doing that on his screen line, and then you have where's Reynolds as the sun comes up. He's the northernmost corps for the Army of Potomac. Where is he?
Right. Yeah, he's just coming up into the outskirts of south of Gettysburg.
Okay, so that's where he starts the morning of the 1st.
Right.
Okay. All right, so now let's talk about so this whole idea we talked about, sustaining the Army of Northern Virginia, you know, the corps are traveling separate, so they're not, you know, completely annihilating every place they go, and preferably they're traveling a little bit different routes as they exist off the land for logistics reasons. That morning, you have Hill's Corps begins to move east towards Gettysburg, and it's primarily, as you kind of alluded to, we're going to go there and we're going to find whatever food stores they have. And the story is Heth went there to Gettysburg to find shoes. Talk about that.
I mean, these guys have been marching since the middle of June, and because you know, Lee is invading, there's of course, that's the only way that they can get from point A to point B is marching. And I don't know if they had decent boots or shoes when they started. So I'd imagine that most of them are probably, a lot of them are marching in socks and rags on their feet. But as most of us infantrymen know, you know, your livelihood is based upon, you know, your boots and your shoes to get you from point A to point B. So there's a little there's contact in the town, and looking at the report of Buford, the night that he was engaged was on the 30th, and on the 30th he says that he did not have information reliable as to the exact location in Gettysburg because he couldn't get information from the inhabitants. So at that particular point, he wasn't sure exactly where. The Confederates were, but he's going to find it out by happenstance and by running in parts of Heath's brigade.
All right, so that's the night of the 30th, and so the morning of the 1st comes up, and Buford's in the vicinity of Gettysburg, so he's still, you know, he's still doing essentially the same thing, which is monitoring the gaps from the valley through the mountains that would come in, and then, you know, his job as a cavalryman is to, you know, is to send reports back onto terrain that would be suitable for them to defend as they begin some kind of engagement with the Army of Northern Virginia. Let's switch now. Lee. Lee's uneasy. Stuart's not there. He doesn't really know what's going on. As he and Hill talk the morning of the 1st, and what is the conversation? Because Lee coincidentally happens to be co-located with A.P. Hill.
Because he doesn't know, and because he kind of has given, I think, a very inspecific or unspecific guidance as to what he wants Ewell and A.P. Hill to do, they're just going to bump and go into battle. Lee is still looking, I think, in his mind, is looking to avoid a fight as of right now, because he hasn't completed what he thinks is a long enough march into the north and to the east of Washington to cause the, you know, the Union Army and President Lincoln concern. So he's trying to get a little bit further north. But I think, in the short run, he's gonna, accept this fight, because I think that's just his personality. he was looking for a place to fight, and it's going to end up being here at Gettysburg by accident, although it wasn't a plan.
Okay, let's talk about that, because I think what Lee's last advice to Hill is, I don't want a general engagement. Don't become decisively engaged. And Heth sets out that morning. Talk to us about that. What is Lee, what's in his head? What is he trying? Why doesn't he want that? What's going on?
Well, primarily he doesn't want to be engaged. I think because of what we talked about earlier, he is uneasy and has no information about where the main army of the Potomac is. So I think it's pretty typical for him, unless he has specific intelligence and information about where his adversary is, and because he is trying to get further north, he's going to provide this kind of instructions and guidance. I don't want to get engaged here. It doesn't fulfill my long-term intention for invasion of Pennsylvania. And secondly, I just don't know where meet it. So let's don't get engaged until we find out exactly where he is. So once again, the impact and the influence of Stuart not being in a little bit closer gives Lee the opportunity to be very inspecific and ambiguous about the guidance that he gives.
Talk to me about the how long does it take, and I'll read you an email here that causes me to ask this. Hey, Mac, I'm curious, as the Army of Northern Virginia is spread out, how long does it take to consolidate it when it's like that? It must have taken a relatively long period of time, a couple days. So, Smitty, in Lee's mind, he doesn't want a general engagement because he's not configured for one. The Army's still on the march, spread out. How long, what is the rule in terms of being able to consolidate an army at this point? How spread out are they? How quickly can they consolidate and fight?
Well, I think from the Confederate perspective, they look to 12 to 15 miles in a day in order to reaggregate. So that kind of drives how far Longstreet's coming up in the distance between, although the distance between Hill and Ewell at this particular point is less than that. But for example, it's going to take a day for a good part of day one for Ewell to turn south and come towards Gettysburg, and he's going to get there in the afternoon. And then Longstreet's not going to get there until the evening of the late evening of the first day. So they're not, in this particular case, they're not all that spread out. The general rule that I've seen is they try to stay within a day or two of aggregating, which means 12 to 15 miles.
All right, so 12 to 15, so that's a day's march. So the Army, Lee, even though the situation's unknown to him, and I'll tell you what, if you could be Lee, if you simply close your eyes and you grope in front of you, that's what Lee's doing. He is incredibly, and this is not the way he does business. On a regular basis, they're a pretty disciplined organization, and Stuart is a big part of that. In allowing the Army of Northern Virginia to come to the fight with a pretty good idea of what's going on. Not only a pretty good idea of what's going on, but they've identified who's where, and they know each other. And it's an interesting part of this fight as they talk. So that would be the time space relative to them getting going. Heth moves towards Gettysburg. Buford sees him coming. Buford decides that the terrain lends itself to engaging Heth. And there's a couple of unique things about Buford in this battle. One is his guys are armed, or at least the majority of his guys are armed, with the Spencer repeating rifle. Now, Smitty, explain why that's significant here. He also has his artillery up, and he communicates with Reynolds early in the morning that says, "I'm engaging. Can you come?" And Reynolds, who's by all accounts a stud of a soldier, sends back to Buford, essentially, "I'm Oscar Mike. I will be there shortly." And with that confidence, Buford begins to engage Heth and is not going to give ground. Talk about the significance of the Spencer rifle, the repeating rifle.
Well, that gives not only additional accuracy, but multiple or more rounds per minute for firing. So that's going to allow suppression. I'd have to double check on the accuracy of the at what particular range is compared to the muskets and some of the other non-rifled pieces at the time. But certainly range increases and accuracy increases and volume of fire, which is, I think, in this day and age, the suppression was what it was that they were trying to achieve until they could get within 50, 100 yards, and then the accuracy of, you know, the musket fire and would be doing the killing. But I think for that reason, and the rifling of the muskets and the mini ball and those types of things are in the Civil War. That's the beginning of what I call modern warfare. When you start looking for accuracy, volume of fire, suppression, it allows you to move and maneuver at a better rate. I think that's the beginning of modern warfare, at least from the modern age.
And one of the interesting things about the Civil War is that technology is the head of the tactics, meaning that the tactics are really, you know, the closed formation, Napoleonic formations that were invented with the musket. The musket, notorious for its inaccuracy, except at close range. Now you have rifling, and it'll take another year or more before you begin to see opened up formations because of the accuracy of the rifle fire and not, you know, people marching onto the battlefield. And so one of the reasons why the casualty rates are so high in these battles are because of that. The rifle fire, the rifling now in these muzzle loaders is incredible. Long-barreled, you know, rifled muskets with incredibly accurate fire. And the Spencer repeating rifles, they're rifles, so with rifling, much accurate. So Heth and Buford begin to begin an exchange of gunfire. Lee hears it, and the thing that makes Lee's ears go up and make he and Hill head that way are the sound of artillery. Talk about that, Smitty. What is when Lee hears artillery, what does he think?
Yeah. Well, he knows now that he's probably going to be engaged, because when you do hear artillery, particularly that early in the morning, you're probably not talking about a cavalry engagement. You're probably talking about at least one of the people fighting is an infantry unit, because in this particular case, it's Gamble's brigade that comes up with Hall's artillery, and then of course Hess artillery. And they're, you know, artillery shooting primarily against each other for a good hour or so.
Right. And well, here's what's interesting: the way the engagement unfolds. Right, Heth's going to, you know, he's going to Gettysburg. Infantry against cavalry is not normally much of a fight. Normally, there's an exchange of gunfire. The cavalrymen saddle up and they take off. You're right; they've made contact. They've done their job. They continue to observe. That's their function. Well, what happens is, when they meet, the volume of fire that Heth gets forces him to deploy his brigade, which, you know, normally, like, what are we doing? Why are we deploying? These are cavalry guys. And then all of a sudden, Buford unloads his artillery. And so you, from Heth's perspective, Heth is like, what the fuck? Right? Like, we should...
I remember is they met in the town of Gettysburg, but they're not fighting... in Gettysburg, they're a mile or a mile.
Yeah.
of Gettysburg. So that means Buford chased Heth's brigade, or those guys that were looking for shoes, back. In other words, it was cavalry on infantry, even though the infantry weren't deployed for fighting. They were just, you know, marching down the road looking for stuff. So they weren't ready to fight. So the cavalry on horses is successful in chasing them all the way back a mile west and until they actually meet Heth and his headquarters at Harris Tavern, I guess is the headquarters there. And that's where they decide to settle down. Buford occupies some pretty good terrain. And then, the Union infantry coming up behind him accepts that terrain as, you know, McPherson's Ridge and just a little bit beyond it to the west. So a good choice of, you know, getting the, pushing the enemy out, reading terrain on the part of Buford. And good call on getting communications back to Reynolds, and then Gamble coming up right behind Buford, so that Buford doesn't have to get in a death spiral there trying to hold off infantry is forming. So,
as this becomes a bit more than Lee wanted. As the artillery begins to duel, then at that point Reynolds, you know, as Buford's about to hit his culminating point, because he can only do so much as a cavalry guy, and he knows it. And but he's also, you know, he's behind a fence. They dismantle a fence, so there's all these little things. And Smitty just talked about the terrain that Buford chose. Buford was a pro, and he shows it here. And, you know, oddly enough, he'll be dead within a year, I think, of this battle. But, a sickness that he dies of. But Buford chooses ground and does a great job. And as he's getting uneasy with his position, Reynolds' First Corps, with Doubleday, Reynolds, they come onto the battlefield. And Reynolds is killed shortly thereafter. And then, so talk about, so now this is the morning. Lee now sees, he hears it, he heads in that direction, and this thing is getting going.
Yeah, so A.P. Hill, you know, basically deploys a good majority of his corps along the Chambersburg Pike, about a mile and a half, 2 miles, on both sides of the road, curving up around to the north and then crossing Willoughby Run to the right or to the south of Chambersburg Pike. So if you look at the battle map, you can see that the Confederates are spreading out in a wide array of not just a single line, but they are in two and three lines as they are, you know, coming around the three roads, I think, that they occupy coming in towards Gettysburg. And then you take a look at the battle map of how Reynolds is formed. He's a little bit more compact, and it stands to good reason that he is a little bit more compact because he is channeled through the town of Gettysburg over that terrain and punching out to the west. So, and it kind of really sets up what's going to happen on day two, the way that they form on the terrain west and north north of Gettysburg. And of course, now you've got Ewell coming straight down, not straight, but from Carlisle, and he's also pushing on.
Yeah. So hold on. Let's talk about that. So this thing gets going in the morning. The whole Heth event with Buford. And towards the mid morning, Reynolds arrives with Doubleday and extends Buford's, they assume, battle lines in front of Seminary Ridge, to the west of Gettysburg, both north and south of the railroad cut. So now you have infantry, you have the First Corps, Reynolds. And so you have Doubleday, Wadsworth, other names you're going to see on a map. And they extend Oak Ridge, which is kind of north of Gettysburg, through the railroad cut, through the Chambersburg Pike, and then down to where Reynolds is killed towards the Fairfield Road. So you have the Union there. So that engagement is brewing and getting going in the mid-morning when Lee now has to send couriers to both Longstreet and to Ewell to, hey, I need you to consolidate in Gettysburg. So that goes out sometime in the morning. Ewell gets that, and then now this is a day's march, right? So Ewell's on the outskirts of Harrisburg, getting ready to get after that, and he's got to stop and turn and head to Gettysburg. And the Army of Northern Virginia begins to consolidate. On the orders go out morning of the first day, and then the rest of the first day is both Longstreet and Ewell moving their corps towards Gettysburg.
Right. So the tail, I can't remember who it is, but the tail end Charlie of Ewell's corps is not in Carlisle. He's a little bit closer.
Right.
So with the word to come, that rear division and those brigades, I think it ends up being Rhodes and Early.
Right.
But they don't have quite so far to come. So they get there within a matter of 4 or 5 hours, but mid-afternoon.
And they're essentially what, almost due north of Gettysburg when these orders come.
Yes,
and they I think they come where I think they're in the vicinity of Carlisle, if I'm not mistaken, which is north of Gettysburg, and they head almost due south, and they get there. They're the first elements of Ewell's corps, and they get there what, late afternoon, as AP Hill's division is taking on Doubleday, and now you have Doubleday not only facing west and the Army of Northern Virginia Hill's corps, but you now have the beginning of Ewell's corps coming onto the battlefield and to the right flank of the Union First Corps that's facing AP Hill. So this gets untenable west of the city, but that happens late in the day. So you can see the operational things, in the theater unfolding as Lee begins to consolidate his army. He's got great confidence, but he still doesn't really know what's out there, who's out there, and he's gone into this battle unprepared, and it's not a deliberate fight.
Yeah, I think that's right. Certainly in the first part of the day, but I think right. In mid to late afternoon, I think he's getting word. Certainly by the evening of the first day, he knows he's going to end up fighting here because he knows now that he's got at least one corps, if not two corps, in Gettysburg of Meade's army.
Right.
And he knows for sure that he's got first corps because Heth is talking to him via AP Hill. 11th Corps is the next one that comes up, and they occupy north of Gettysburg, and there's some confusing movements out of Howard's 11th Corps as they move to deploy to keep Early from crashing in from Carlisle too fast, getting into Gettysburg. But they do well enough to keep Ewell from occupying good terrain inside of the town of Gettysburg in specific. But it is a touch-and-go fight on in the afternoon of day one between Howard's corps and Ewell. Basically, it's Early and a little bit of Rhodes that are coming down from Carlisle.
And that's so you have that coming from 12 o'clock, and then late in the day, you have Ewell coming from about, what, 1, 2 o'clock. So it's, yeah. Smitty talked about, Gettysburg is essentially the center of a hub of, what'd you say, as many as 10 different roads meet at Gettysburg. Amazing.
Yep, at least 10, and then there's more spider-type roads that branch off of those 10. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. And I don't know that it has never been done, but maybe it has. But doing some research on the impact of roads on the movement of corps in the Civil War would be interesting, particularly in this particular case here in the invasion of that Lee brings into the north.
And one of the things that that Reynolds and then Doubleday, this is the Doubleday who invented baseball, by the way. Same guy. One of the things that he has to deal with is his right flank, his northern flank, as he faces AP Hill and is fighting. AP Hill deploys his corps to fight, and this engagement becomes a general engagement. One of the things that Doubleday has to deal with is his right flank is threatened early by the lead elements that Smitty talked about, roads and whatnot. And then what happens is they begin to have to bend it back. And then Howard comes onto the battlefield. I think Howard is the 12th Union Corps, but he comes through, essentially moves through Gettysburg, as the elements the trail elements of Ewell's Corps begin to move into Gettysburg. Howard comes in from the southern end and restores the right flank of Doubleday's position. And then there's Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill. And ultimately, as Ewell comes in now from 2 o'clock, there the right flank of the Union of the Army of the Potomac gets extended in that direction, and they have a meeting engagement there. And that essentially is the position that day one ends at. And so talk about the end of day one, Smitty. From Lee's perspective, what happened, then we'll talk about it from Meade's perspective.
Yeah. From Lee's perspective, he basically wants to occupy good terrain in Gettysburg. I don't think he has a good feel for the surrounding terrain outside of Gettysburg, particularly to the west and to the north, and a little bit further to the south. But he knows that there's good terrain inside of Gettysburg at Cemetery Hill. So he gives, once again, indecisive instructions to Ewell, take it if practicable.
Right.
And this, of course, is in the late evening. And we're talking 2000, 2100 at night. It's getting dark. You give Ewell some very imprecise guidance. Ewell's going to choose not to take it. Whereas I think in Lee's mind, he hasn't really made the shift between giving those kind of wide, broad guidance to Jackson, who had the Second Corps in Chancellorsville, and having to now give specific or more specific guidance to another corps commander who is not a Jackson at all.
Right.
So I think he's struggling a little bit with the personalities, and the job of any commander is to understand subordinates so you can give them the exact guidance or that they need. In this particular case, he leaves it once again the decision in the hands of Ewell. And Ewell stays outside of Gettysburg and allows the 11th Corps and the rest of Sickles and the rest of the other guys to come in and occupy Culp's Hill, Cemetery Hill, and they basically start forming their defense using the terrain surrounding Gettysburg as their background.
You know, and there's two dynamics at work that I think are really interesting. One is the Union, the Army of the Potomac's better. And you see it at Gettysburg. They have better guys commanding, and those guys get the key spots, and they make good decisions. Lee's army is feeling the loss of Jackson, and as Smitty just said, Lee doesn't know Ewell like he knew Jackson, and he gives kind of a mission order and gives him discretion, whereas probably after this, he probably wouldn't have issued the same order. But one of the facts of life, of combat, and certainly in the Civil War, was, you know, people are going to get killed. And you've got to learn, you know, the next guy up and the next guy you put in charge. And that doesn't always happen right away. It sometimes it takes time. And you see that here on late in the afternoon of the first day. Much, much debate after the war about Ewell's decision not to press it. Had Jackson been there, he certainly would have. At least that's what everybody says. And Lee doesn't know Ewell well enough. Talk to us, so from Meade's perspective, but, you know, essentially from, Lee's perspective, you know, they joined the battle, it became a general engagement. They pushed the Union off the battlefield and back into Gettysburg. The army's now consolidated. So, you know, maybe it could have gone quicker, maybe it could have gone better. But, you know, Lee's found the Union Army. The Army's consolidated. Longstreet's, you know, following A.P. Hill over the through Cashtown, and the Army will be up tomorrow. Lee's not, you know, things are okay with the Army of Northern Virginia, yes?
Yes. One of the other aspects of being in the both armies are in the offense, but one's going to go into the defense. But if you look at the how the Army of Northern Virginia gets into position in Gettysburg, because they've got Ewell to the north, they've got Hill to the west, and Longstreet is going to be to the west, but he kind of toward to the southwest. They have longer lines of communication between not just the corps, but to the corps and back to Lee. Whereas if you take a look at how the Army of the Potomac moves in, they are not quite as dispersed laterally. They're dispersed linearly. Easier to communicate up and down a line like that as it is across a broad band of three corps like the Army of Northern Virginia sprout. So there is the occupation of terrain by the Union Army helps in their communication and helps, and it's going to help up immensely on day two and day three when they have to move corps and divisions around to meet the attacks where they come from. Conversely, on the offensive side, much more logistics, much more better communications is required in order to coordinate attacks from two or three different positions on the clock, as it were.
Okay. And from Meade's perspective, he's you know, he's been informed of events throughout the day. This was you know, he Buford communicated with him relative to what was going on the battle. So Meade moves into this with some of his better commanders. Reynolds now dead, which is, they all feel his loss, when you read what they wrote, after the battle, cause Reynolds, was held in incredibly high regard by the Army and shot in the head, as his corps, you know, took to the field, to support Buford. But Meade, as he shows up, you know, he shows up and he sees the line, that they have, and he's not disappointed by where they are. The position that he's on has defensible lines on it. It's commanding terrain, and so by all accounts, Meade he's okay. He's okay with what happened as well.
I think so. And what you said about the communication between cavalry, who is working directly for the Army commander, you cannot be overemphasized in this particular case. And I think that was it was a game changer. And of course, you know, Howard's moving to the west out along Seminary Ridge. That's good terrain.
Right.
He looks down and kind of towards, out to the west in Chambersburg Pike there. But it is good terrain. It is the effective use of terrain in keeping Heth and A.P. Hill out of Gettysburg while the rest of the Army of the Potomac moves up from the south into Gettysburg to find good terrain. So a lot of good things on day one for the Union with regards to Buford, Reynolds, and Doubleday's actions along Seminary Ridge. And then not quite as good actions done by Howard's Corps, but it's effective enough to keep Early from crashing in from the north from Carlisle.
And relative to Lee's admonition to Heth early in the morning and Stuart not being there, by the end of the night, as the sun comes down, the Confederates own the battlefield. They have they've pushed the First Corps and Buford from the western approach to Gettysburg. They now live on that position, so that they've kind of owned the day, if you will. And not perfect, but by all accounts, not Lee not tremendously disturbed that night, in spite of Stuart not being around. And so the Army's going to consolidate at Gettysburg, and we're going to see what the next day brings. Email says, "Hey Mac, where is Stuart, and when does he arrive at Gettysburg?" I don't think Stuart gets there until the following day.
Evening, I think, of the second.
Of the second day.
So he's in, he's kind of out in the vicinity of Hanover. He's kind of making an arc from Hanover. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with Hanover, but Hanover is just across the border from Maryland into Pennsylvania at the junctions of several railroads. But he's in that vicinity there, angling to the north and northwest up towards Carlisle. And he's eventually going to get to the north of Gettysburg, where he is going to have to come back as well. But it's not going to be until towards the evening of day two.
So you can imagine, Stuart, the sinking feeling that he had in his stomach as he, you know, as because, again, he knows what he knows what his job is for the Army of Northern Virginia. And he certainly knows that he's not where he's supposed to be. And that's incredibly, if that's your mission and, you know, you've been given discretion, I don't know of a more sinking feeling, as a leader that you would have, than probably the one that, that Stuart had, when he showed up, and that, I've let the, you know, not just Lee down, but I've let the Army down in terms of what I've done. I was given discretion, and I missed it. Ultimately, you know, Stuart, you know, as Smitty said, I mean, he ultimately has to go to Carlisle to get around with his trains and some of the stuff he's captured. You know, he thought he was having a good week, and then ultimately, so to answer the email, late in the afternoon of day two, Stuart comes onto the battlefield. So that's where it ends. Now, the supporting units for the Army of the Potomac are now south of theirs. So they'll continue to close on Gettysburg as Meade now attempts to consolidate his army before Lee can attack. So, you know, one of the interesting things about this battle is the time-space relationship between the different corps and the ability as you march to keep them all within supporting distances, knowing that they ought to travel different paths for sustainment purposes. So you see this juggling of, you know, routes, yet being able to consolidate it, which was a bit of an art during that era.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to do just a little bit more reading on that, the bringing up of the tail end of the seven corps that Meade's got. But it's going to take all the way into day three for them to close, at least right. The tail end folks. So they've got some traveling to do and fighting at the end of the traveling, which is pretty par for the course, I think.
All right, give me a couple keys to day one at Gettysburg in your mind.
Confederates, not having eyes and ears and reconnaissance out is going to hurt Lee in achieving what I think he is going to be unable to achieve, even though he's inside of Pennsylvania. Not understanding subordinates to the degree that he needs to in order to give specific guidance to a commander whose personality needed it. On the Union side,
and in that you're talking about Ewell, right? And the communique, if at all practicable, you know, take that hill.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And that hill would be the Culp's Hill Cemetery Hill, where the cemetery will ultimately go at that, where Lincoln gives his address. But that complex up there is what Smitty's talking about. Right.
Yes, that's correct. And then from the Union side, Meade's perspective, excellent use of cavalry to find out where the bad guys are, where the Confederates are. Good coordination bringing the infantry up in time to pull your cavalry and put them elsewhere on the battlefield that you need. Good initiative and decision-making on the part of Reynolds and Doubleday on selecting the best terrain. And then the movement of Howard and his corps to keep Ewell specifically early at bay so that Reynolds and Doubleday can finish off or keep AP Hill out of the town. I think, you know, those are four or five things that I would say resulted in where we're at in the day one.
To me, as I said, I think the first string for the first time for the Army of the Potomac plays at Gettysburg. And Howard moving his corps, getting them there, to be honest with you, in the nick of time to save the right flank late in the afternoon. Or else the Union has to give up, you know, Gettysburg and the area south of Gettysburg, and they would have fought someplace else at some point. But the professionalism and the drive of the Union commanders that day, and it starts with Buford and Reynolds as a team. Doubleday steps in and acquits himself well. And Hancock's part of that, and then Howard late in the day. It is to me where you see the emergence of every time this thing hangs in the balance, a Union commander does something right, and it's never happened in the war before. And so, to me, the Army of the Potomac's a bit different. And I would say from Lee's perspective, he can't be displeased, given the absence of Stuart, what's happened, right? They ran him off the battlefield. You know, they'll get after him again tomorrow. The Army's now consolidated. He feels better, but he doesn't know where Stuart is, and that's disturbing. But all in all, given Stuart's absence, he can't be displeased with the way that it went. The trail elements of Ewell's Corps responded quickly, and were it not for Howard's movement late in the day into Gettysburg, would have collapsed the right flank of the First Corps. So I think all in all, you know, it wasn't perfect, which it rarely is, but Lee's got his guys together. And you and I both know he's not afraid of the Union Army. He knows them. He's whooped their ass for years. And when the sun comes up tomorrow, they'll do it again. So, anyway. All right, Smitty, any final thoughts?
No, I think we pretty well covered it. There was a little bit of an engagement in front of a Seminary Hill that was pretty devastating on the part of the Union. A couple of divisions moved out on their own without covering their flanks, and they got side blinded. But there's a lot of small tactical things like that, bad decision making that didn't necessarily affect the overall end of the day type things, but just some real crazy decision making. You know, in the din of battle, probably not all that abnormal to make.
Well, and the other thing is that we talked about earlier, the tactics are, they need to be changed, but they're not. And so when you do make a mistake like that, the consequences are deadly because the rifle fire, the artillery fire is so devastating, that guys who do, you know, unwittingly move to the wrong spot, they get annihilated. I mean, their units get destroyed by just withering rifle and artillery fire, and it's one of the incredible things about the Civil War. The level of death and destruction is amazing to read about. So.
Yeah, and I think the takeaway would be with regards to tactics and technology. If the tactics aren't changing, that means you're not thinking. You're not thinking about your adversary. You're not thinking about the use of technology that helps you not only from a friendly perspective get to the position of advantage, but how to put your adversary at a disadvantage using the technology. And I've always thought that the tactics, the thinking goes first, and you bring in the technology and the weapon systems to help you become more effective at the tactical level, which is all designed. Should be designed to support your strategy of what you're doing.
Well, you know, it's interesting from the Union Army perspective in that they don't have the right guys, and so they're not thinking, right? And then what they're doing, they're trying to avoid getting their ass kicked, which is in itself its own problem. Then they get the professionals there, then they begin to have some success, and then you see them begin to evolve their tactics. So it's like you can't do it without the right guys. And even once you get the right guys there, it takes them a while to figure it out, to get enough repetitions to say, hey. And so where's the first time we see more open order at Spotsylvania? Is that where we see more?
Certainly, Spotsylvania Grant is going to change a little bit. Of course, whether or not that's the result of additional thinking or whether it's just the personality of a commander is a topic for discussion, I think.
All right, sir. First of all, I appreciate your time today. A little bit longer than I thought, but as always, we love talking about this kind of stuff. And this is one of the great battles because so much has been written on it, and the battlefield still, very much like, Antietam, Sharpsburg, is still very much in its, in the way it was, during the battle. So it's an awful lot of fun to go to. It was written about tremendously, Smitty, did I send you the letter from League's Engineer? Did I send that to you?
No, I don't think. Yeah, that would be nice to see.
I'll send it to you. In the aftermath of the Civil War, in the Southern Historical Society papers, these issues like "Why Didn't Ewell Go?" were written about extensively, back and forth. You had supporters of Longstreet, you had supporters of Lee, you had supporters of Ewell, writing articles defending their commanding officers. And one of the big controversies is Longstreet on day two. But one of the things that I found in Douglas Southall Freeman's papers, was a footnote, that I saw in one of his volumes. And that was Lee's engineer officer, a captain by the name of S.R. Johnston, who writes to Lafayette McLaws, and McLaws is trying to defend Longstreet from this insinuation that somehow or other he drug his feet. And the letters are incredible because, you know, the pronouns are I, blah, blah, I, he, instead of, you know, somebody writing 100 years later. And one of the great passages out of these letters is Johnston describing Lee waking him up near the fire on the morning of the second day to go do his reconnaissance of Little Round Top. And it's awesome. We returned to headquarters. It was dark by then. Up to that time, I had heard nothing of General Lee's plans for the second day. I slept that night very near General Lee. About 4 o'clock the next morning, General Lee called me and directed that I go at once and make a reconnaissance as far as practicable to our right. I did not know then that another engineer officer was to accompany me, and I was joined by Major J.C. Clark of General Longstreet's staff, who had been sent out by General Longstreet. And so, is that awesome or what? right? I mean, for those of us that are geeks about this kind of stuff, you know, and so this is just from a footnote that I saw in Lee's Lieutenants. And I went up to the National Archives, I registered, and they brought me Douglas Southall Freeman's papers. And it was in the box that they said it was going to be in. So it was in box 7, you know, of blah, 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 blah. So I said, I need box 7. So you're looking through his papers, for God's sake. And here's the letter, and I made a copy of it. And I just happened to talk to a friend of ours, Dave High, who's from Tennessee and who's a student of the Civil War. And I scanned it and sent it to him. So I will send it along to you. You'll enjoy it. But he essentially he gives Lee the wrong assessment. The Union on day two is further south than he tells Lee they are. And as a result, you know, the plan is made with the expectation that they're going to march to the south and then get on the Chambersburg Pike. Is it the Chambersburg Pike? And they're going to essentially roll up the Union left flank. But the Union left flank is considerably further south. And so day two ensues, but we'll get to that. I will send you these. You'll enjoy them. It's great stuff. So, Smitty, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
All right, my friend. Thank you.
There you have it. That is a retired Marine Corps Colonel Phil Smith here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio when we're talking a little bit of military history. We're going to take a quick break. More of this program coming up next. You're listening to All Marine Radio.